Our next speaker is Don Chichester. When I was flipping through the membership list of ours, trying to come up with some ideas for people to invite to the conference, I spied Don Chichester's name, and it pleased me very much because I have a kind of a personal radio relation to Don Chichester. I was living in a motel in Kingston, Ontario, going out every day with real estate agents looking for a farm that eventually became my home, and coming back very depressed at the end of the day. And the thing I always felt saved my sanity in those weeks, if you've ever driven out consistently with real estate agents, was tuning into National Public Radio out of Oswego, New York, which is just over the lake from Kingston, and tuned into Don Chichester's program, Spirit 78. Don Chichester's pastor of the Eastminster United Presbyterian Church in Erie, Pennsylvania. He also produces the enormously entertaining radio program heard here and there on National Public Radio called The Spirit of 78. His congregation may be Presbyterian, but his program is Catholic in its embrace of 78 recording materials. He has interviewed numerous senior musicians and entertainers, from conductor Walter Hendel to Larry Feinberg, the stooge in the middle. One week he may be playing Art Tatum, and the next week he's focusing on railroad songs. I'm very pleased that Pastor Chichester has agreed to be with us today to speak about the Spirit of 78.
The weekly production of a one-hour radio program devoted to the 78 RPM phonograph record may seem like a simple process. Just pull out a bunch of records, do a little research on them, and then spin your discs for a week, for an hour, or spin your wheels, perhaps. But right from the start, when I began the program, obviously the title comes from the speed of the records. That causes some concern with people who hear me for the first time and think it has to do with the year. It was particularly difficult in 1976, the year of the bicentennial, that they wondered why it wasn't the Spirit of 76 and not the Spirit of 78. However, when I began listening to the program, I set a more rigid parameter for the show, for myself. First, I decided that each program would be thematic in content, a singer, a musician, a particular topic. Some of those were mentioned, others like songs about the summer or music from 40 years ago this week or the like. In a sense, this freed me from a limitless array of records. If any of you have ever done this, you know it's hard to know what to play. And rather, it concentrated my choices, in a sense, made it easier. Secondly, I chose to make my show more than just another DJ with records. Hence, my program has included personal interviews with some of the very performers who made the 78s 40 or 50 or even 60 years ago. And this choice has afforded many surprises along the span of the 10 years or so of my program. Now, in order to interview these performers, two things are necessary. First, you have to locate them, and secondly, you have to make an arrangement to interview them. The first step was easier than I had anticipated. My listeners have been the best resource for personalities. They'll send me letters and tell me about such and such performer who lives in their neighborhood, who hasn't performed in years, they know personally, and that person would be very interested in being a guest on the program. They give me the address, I write, get permission, we work out an arrangement, and make an interview. A fan from Portland, Oregon, for instance, had vacationed in Houston, Texas, and through a friend had met Seeger Ellis, whose name I hope is known to some of you. Raise your hand if you know who is Seeger Ellis. Thank you. Okay. He was a singer, band leader, composer, and an agent, whose career started in the mid-20s and continues today, although to a much lesser degree. Now, the interview itself is quite simple. All you need is a console. We've seen plenty of them, haven't we? And a radio station. Yeah. And a radio station with a phone patch. Then, at a prearranged time, you can talk with your guest for as long as your time or your money holds out, and later edit it for airplay. I like to let the guest carry the show and illustrate his or her comments with the recordings, appropriate to that particular point being made. I usually program my show chronologically to avoid abrupt changes in style of music. Now, rather than play 30 minutes of records, I thought you might enjoy hearing four vignettes gleaned from my program, which highlight four personalities often overlooked by the biographies, yet who either made 78s or worked with those who did. My first guest falls into that latter category. He never recorded, but he led a band in the 1920s in the Chicago area, at the time of the likes of Bick Spiderbeck, Benny Goodman, and the Austin High Gang, with whom he was very intimately familiar. Jimmy Caldwell. He's in his early 80s and lives in retirement in Salem, Oregon. He gave up the music business when he married and became a successful CPA, ending his career as vice president of Montgomery Ward. His memory's razor sharp. He's been quoted in the book Bix by Richard Sudhalter. He loves to reminisce about the days of his band and of Don Murray and of Bix. I'd like you to listen to this part of the interview.
Get involved with Bick Spiderbeck in the first place?
Well, remember, I was born in 1901. I'm 81 years old. Bick Spiderbeck was born in 1903. Now, at the time I first knew him was when he was at Lake Forest Academy in the fall of 1921. We played a dance for Lake Forest Academy. When I say we, I mean my jazz band. And he asked to sit in. This is October 1st, 1921. So we had him sit in, and I was quite impressed with his imaginative licks, and he had some arrogance. I mean, the kid was not a bashful boy at all, although he was a little quiet-spoken. But so I decided to use him when I could. Now, I had several dates ahead, and I kept in touch with him, and at Thanksgiving time, that would be in November 23, 24, and 25, Bix's parents agreed he needn't come home over the weekend, the Thanksgiving weekend. And the headmaster at the Lake Forest Academy liked the idea of Bix having a place to stay that was in good repute in the Chicago area. Mm-hmm. So he agreed that Bix could stay with me at the Sigma Chi house in my charge, and which he did. And that's the weekend in which we discovered him turning the Victrola down to get the fancy licks of the jazz band boys.
What do you mean turning it down?
He turned it down an octave, or a good part of an octave.
Oh, slowed the speed.
Slowed the speed, and was able, I don't know that he turned it down a full octave, I don't remember, but at least he had enough imagination to study the licks and put them in B-flat or E-flat where he could play them. So that's the part of that I think is colorful.
Mm.
Now, we used him on Wednesday night at a dance given by the Three Arts Club in the Chicago area. We used him on a Thursday night at the Congress Hotel and on a Friday night at the Black Cat Room. After the Congress Hotel and Black Cat Room affairs, we all went to the Friars Inn in downtown Chicago to see and hear the New Orleans Rhythm King.
Mm.
And if my recollection is accurate, at that time, the New Orleans Rhythm Kings were kind of an offshoot from the original jazz band, and they included Leon Ropolo on the clarinet,
mm-hmm.
Paul Maris, M-A-R-E-S, on the trumpet, and Georgie Brunus on the trombone. And the thing I remember about Brunus, not only was he fantastically good and very original, but he could play the trombone out of the side of his mouth. He'd play a stanza from the left side, then he'd move the horn over to the right side of his mouth, which I thought was fantastic.
Yeah.
Georgie Brunus. Well, anyway, to continue the big story, let me turn a page. I've noted some of this stuff down so that I don't miss it. And on January 26, 1922, we used Bix at the Sen High School prom. Now, you've read about that in the Bix Beiderbecke story.
Mm-hmm.
The Sen High School prom, where we built our group up to 10 men, and Bix starred quite well that night, starting out with the number we called Fidgety Feet. On March 10, I used him at the Northwestern Senior Ball. On March 24th, we used him in the Black Cat Room. On April 22nd, in the Black Cat Room. And May 18th, in the Black Cat Room. Now, that's all the information I have about using Bix. I might say that the reason that we were able to use him, the headmaster had been having trouble with Bix stealing out at night, and nobody knew where the hell he was. So the headmaster, when he found that he was in good hands with us fellas, he would agree to Bix coming into town and playing with him. So that's the end of the Bix story, except that at the that summer, my prospective bride, as I told you in one of my letters, had told me that she wasn't going to marry a man that was going to be playing music all night, sleeping all day. So there was a boy by the name of Bill Grimm, a piano player, who was also a Sigma Chi, one of my brothers, took over the remnants of my group. And he hired himself out on a Lake Michigan summer boat for the summer of 1922, and Bix and Don Murray went along with him. And they also did the same thing in 1923. So meanwhile, I'm working in the loop in Chicago as a young accountant for a firm of CPAs. Then Bix and Benny Goodman met when Benny filled in a Grimm's vacancy in August 1923. And then from then on, Bix was, and Goodman, of course, were under great demand, and they had no trouble lining themselves up. Bix got into the Wolverines, and so did Don Murray, and then later got in with Gene Goldcat, and finally Bix lined up with Paul Whiteman in, I think it was 1927, and from that time on, he was with the big band until he died.
Any Sigma Chi's in the audience? One final item. Jimmy Caldwell's son, Jim Caldwell, is the host of the TV game show Tic-Tac-Doe. The name Charlie Davis may not ring a bell with most of you. Curious to know. How many of you know who Charlie Davis? Thank you. But the discerning jazz enthusiast might recall that it was Charlie Davis who wrote the classic jazz melody Copenhagen, named incidentally for the snuff, not the city. The avid dance band collector will also recall that Charlie Davis led a stage band out of Indianapolis that went to all the major theaters in the East Coast, New York, and in Brooklyn. I didn't get in touch with Charlie, he got in touch with me. He hears my show in Oswego, New York, where he lives after retiring from a successful career in the furniture business. He owned, until he retired, the largest furniture store in Oswego, New York. He gave up the music business early in the 1930s. He now writes and has published a book about his days in the band business called That Band from Indiana. Listen to what Charlie has to say.
Again, it is the pleasure of the Perfect Circle Company manufacturers of Perfect Circle piston rings, to present Charlie Davis and his famous Indiana Public Stage Orchestra. These programs of the best in popular music are especially arranged for your entertainment by Mr. Davis and the Perfect Circle Company. The orchestra greets you tonight with Mean to Me.
When did you start the band?
When I start my band?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think when I got out of college, 1921.
21, huh?
Yeah.
What was your instrument, a piano?
I played piano and trumpet, yeah.
Ah, yes. And did you start out in Indiana?
Up at Notre Dame at South Bend.
Oh, it was a college band?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And you began to do one-nighters, or did you...
Yeah, we played dances all around the state of Indiana.
A regional band.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We became a theater band, you know. Our band became, we played the stage band. I don't know whether you know about the Public Units.
Public, oh yes.
Public Units.
Yeah.
We backed up the Public Units at the Indiana Theater in Memphis for some time, and we were, I think they, according to Milton Feld, who was the vice president of Public Units, he said we were the best band on the circuit. And when Rudy Valley was taken out of Brooklyn, they brought us down here to fill in for Rudy Valley.
I see.
And that was our trip to New York, and we stayed there about a year, alternating between the Brooklyn Paramount and the New York Paramount, backing up these stage presentations.
I understand you had someone who went on to greater fame in another area that was with your band back in those days. I'm speaking of Dick Powell.
Yeah, Dick was our banjo player.
He started out with you, didn't he?
Yeah, I gave him a banjo and showed him how to play it. And nice boy, could sing pretty good.
Yeah, I guess he could. Yeah, he went on to movies and then television.
Yeah.
He recorded with you, too, I believe.
Oh, yeah, I think he made that, did he?
No,
yeah,
I think
he did Suppose Nobody Cared, my tune.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a bit, he did You're a Real Sweetheart. I think he was a vocal on that, too.
You wrote some of your music.
Huh?
You wrote music as well?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Copenhagen's my tune, you know.
Oh, of course it is. That's one of the most famous, sure.
Yeah, Copenhagen still pays royalties about $700 a year on Copenhagen royalties already. Every year.
That's absolutely marvelous.
Yeah,
that's fun. Yes, I hear that all the time, of course. What was it that broke up the band? When did you break up and what broke?
Well, I'll tell you, the story about my band is kind of a crazy story because when I asked Mommy to marry me, she said, I'll marry you, but I don't want no minstrel in my family. And I said, if you marry me, I'll quit after 10 years.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. I played 10 years and I quit.
So it had nothing to do with the Depression or one-nighters?
No. We went great guns all the time. We never had any depression.
Great. What did you do after you broke up the band?
Went in the furniture business.
Really?
Yeah.
As sales or in manufacturing?
No, I got a furniture store right down here right now.
Where is that, Oswego?
Oswego, New York.
And somebody told me that you might be doing some writing now.
Well, I've got I just brought out a book, Got Banned from Indiana. Pretty good book, not too bad. You ought to get a copy of it. I'll send you a copy if you give me your address.
Okay, I will at the end.
Your comments on these Perfect Circle programs will be appreciated, both by Mr. Davis and the Perfect Circle Company. Please address them either to the Perfect Circle Company at Hagerstown, Indiana, or to this station. This is Robert Brown announcing.
Bob Brown lives in Lexington.
Still alive, Lexington, Kentucky. Someday I'm going to get him on the program, so I just can say that, you know. Norman Layden is presently associate director of the Oregon Philharmonic, but in former years he was a noted arranger for the top vocalists in our nation, vocalists such as Don Cornell, Guy Mitchell, Mary Martin, Tony Martin, no relation. He got his first break by being called to work with Glenn Miller's Air Force Band as an arranger. After the war, this led to freelance work in New York and later with Arthur Godfrey. Here's what Norman Layden shared one day.
To get hooked up with the Air Force Band?
Well, if you had a few hours, I could tell you the whole story, but briefly, I was in the Army assigned to a post at Atlantic City, where the basic training center was at that time.
You were a musician at the time?
Oh, yes, I was in a band work, and I was at the head of quite a large aggregate of musicians, some of the finest ones around, as a matter of fact, because everybody was in the Army in those days, as you well know, and it just happened to be that Atlantic City Basic Training Center was the site to which Miller had selected to send all his chosen musicians when he gave up his civilian band in the fall of 42. He went into the Air Force, and it was well known that he was going to organize a band in the service, and he had all his men sent to Atlantic City, all the ones that he wanted to have with him, sent to Atlantic City for their basic training center. And so here I was going about my military duties and my musical duties, and in would come these hotshot musicians from Benny Goodman's band or Glenn's band or all the rest of them, and I wondered what was going on, and they would always say, well, Miller sent us, and we didn't know what was in the works, of course, but all of a sudden, there he was himself, Captain Glenn Miller, one day. Oh. Hello, I'm Captain Miller, so I'm Sergeant Layden, and how do you do? And that's where we met. I remember the first, about the first day we did meet, he took my wife and me to a seafood dinner at Hackney's restaurant on the pier at Atlantic City.
Had it been taken over by the service? Atlantic City was pretty much taken over by the service at that point?
Oh, yes. All those hotels were full of servicemen. There were thousands of them there. They were parading up and down the boardwalk, and we had to march them up and down every day, in addition to playing our concerts and everything else.
Well, did he approach you with an opportunity to join the band?
No, he didn't, Don. We did organize a band with his library right there at Atlantic City, and we played for the troops at the mess halls every day, a couple of them, and it was great fun rehearsing with him his own book. That's where I first learned how to play his music, having him rehearse us, you see. And then I played tenor sax, and He once paid me a rather dubious compliment. He says, you know, for a Yale man, you don't play bad tenor, whatever that means. So after playing with him in the mess hall there for a couple of months, he took his picked group of musicians with him away from Atlantic City, and they were stationed later at the Yale University. And they did their work there and came into New York City to produce the I Sustain the Wings program.
That was a broadcast. It was a sort of a promotion for the service, wasn't it?
Air
Force.
Yes, it was. And there was all lots of patriotic institutional advertising on that show. And that was where he first began to use his big band with strings. And he had a 20, we had a 20-piece string, I'd say we, he, had a 20-piece string session composed of the finest players and the finest symphonies in the land. And it was a wonderful sounding group. There were about 50 altogether.
In one band.
In one band, yeah. His own regular instrumentation, plus a French horn, which was new to him, and plus all those strings, and a set of arrangers also, including Jerry Gray, his right arm as an arranger.
Is that right?
Yeah. And so...
Well, how did you enter in the picture then? Did he go overseas, or did you go overseas?
He began to do those programs from New York City, of which collectors have quite a few now, as you may know, of those broadcasts. He began to do those in New York City. Meanwhile, my military career found me next, after Atlantic City, down in North Carolina at a small Air Force flying field there, and charged for about a 28-piece band. And one day, about 6 months after all this other meeting had happened, I received a telephone call from New York City, and it was Captain Glenn Miller asking for Sergeant Layden, and he offered me, he says, how would you like to come to New York and conduct the Air Force show Wing Victory on Broadway? Well, what do you think my answer was? And because of his connections, he was able to just have me transferred there, and I helped to organize the orchestra for that famous Air Force Broadway show.
Is that 43?
43, yes, in the fall of 43. After having done a few of these arrangements for that band, I asked him toward the end of our New York run, and said, could you use me in New Haven? He said yes, and had me transferred to his unit. I thought I was going to get off the road because the Air Force show was going on tour, but it turned out that I was only just beginning to go on the road, because almost as soon as we got to New Haven, D-Day happened, and we were on a boat on the Queen Elizabeth about 2 weeks later, headed for Europe.
June 6, 1944.
Something like that. And we were on a boat about 15th of June, I think. After Paris was liberated and the Allied troops began to push the Germans back, Miller naturally wanted to be where the action was to play for the troops. So they made plans to go to France. See, I think Paris was liberated in November. And in December, they made plans for him to go over and then the band to follow to resume, do the same things in Paris that we had been doing just outside of London. So he made arrangements to fly over in a private plane, or a small plane anyway. I don't say it's private because it was, of course, a service plane, but there were just two other people with him. And they took off on December the 15th, 1944, on a very foggy day, and were never seen again. And, of course, all manner of rumors have persisted ever since, but there really is no other answer than that something went wrong with that plane in the middle of that fog, and the plane is somewhere in the English Channel.
Mm-hmm. You don't expect it was shot?
I doubt it. I don't think anybody could see it to shoot it. There wasn't any action at that time, and they would have had to gone very far off their course to get in range of any enemy gunfire.
Well, now this must have changed your plans for the future somewhat.
Indeed it did. As a matter of fact, at the time he disappeared, I was really feeling terrific just before this happened, because he had called me in a few days before the 15th of December and said, Norm, I'd like to have you work for me after the war. And this was a dream coming true, because Glenn had always been my idol. Since I first started arranging, I was trying to arrange like his band when I heard it come on the air in 1938. And so here I was being offered a job, and so we shook hands on a deal, and that was the last I saw of him.
As freelancer, you worked with the studio bands in New York?
That's right. I lived just outside New York City, and the work of a freelance arranger, of course, is quite interesting because you never know what's going to happen when the phone rings, who's going to, what kind of a job you're going to be asked to do and for whom.
You mean somebody just call up and say, hey, Norman, we'd like to have an arrangement of XYZ song, and can you help us out? Is that it?
Well,
essentially
I suppose that's a little simplification, but essentially that's right. It could be Mitch Miller calling up and say, I've got a certain vocalist I want you to write an arrangement for. It could be RCA Victor calling up and say, Norman, we got a kiddie album, or you're going to do a soundtrack for Pinocchio or something like that. So you just never knew, and this is what made it fascinating, because you had to be ready to work in any style that was demanded of you, and have the job ready on time, and have it recordable, as like in your
yes,
your theme song.
Yeah.
Also during that time, this was the time of the big quiz shows in New York, and I was music director from the beginning on the $64,000 question. Did you know that?
Until the debacle.
Until the debacle. Actually, $64,000 question was never on trial. It was some of the other ones, but it reflected on all of them, and so they all went under at the same time.
That's right. Maybe it wasn't.
It was 21 was the problem show, I believe,
yeah,
and then they began to suspect all of them. All I can tell you is that the music was honest. I didn't know if the answers were fixed. I didn't know it. I got my cues from the answers there. If they answer and they say right, I play QA. If it's wrong, we play the other cue.
Did you have to lead the orchestra in that stupid little music when the clock went around?
Don't call it stupid. I wrote that.
Dum 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 dum.
Well. I wrote the theme music for the show, and that was just a permutation of the theme music.
I see.
Yeah, it was played in the minor, which just, thanks for calling it stupid. Listen, that was a good job.
Yeah, probably did very well.
Yeah.
And where did you go after that? Is that when you went out to Poland?
No.
Well, carry on.
See, I don't know if your show is long enough for all this interview.
We got the tape.
Yeah. Well, after a few years on the Godfrey show, I left that, and Dick Hyman was the fellow that came in after me. You asked me a while ago about
that.
And when I came out, so I suddenly found that the music picture was looking quite different from when it was when I went in '56 or so. During that time, we had the beginnings of the rock era, and. You know, when you were a freelance arranger back in the 50s, when you got called for a recording date, you know, you sometimes had 20 people in the studio, or 30, or it was a respectable size orchestra, and you had to really work at your craft and use all that you knew about music to write these backgrounds for the singers. And along about 1960, when I got back into the music scene, coming off the Godfrey show, because you see, the Godfrey show was so time-consuming, there was no time for other jobs. Mm-hmm. And so I started to get back into freelance and found that I wasn't as much in demand as I was before, simply because instead of orchestras now, they'd have five guys come in with guitars and no music and do everything out of their head and make these hit rock records. So arrangers were kind of becoming passé.
Same with the big band.
Yeah, well, big bands were gone by that time. And that's another subject we can discuss another time. But so I decided, well, for self-preservation, I better equip myself to, well, I could become a pretty good college teacher. I've got the background, and so I decided to get credentials to teach in college, and I went back to Columbia Teachers College. And this was about 40 years after I'd graduated from Yale. But I stuck it out and got a master's and doctorate from Columbia, and then we went to Portland, ostensibly for 1 year to conduct a youth symphony orchestra, but things fell into place, and I got a job with the university there, and then the following year got in with the Oregon Symphony, and I've been with the Oregon Symphony for 15 years now, as they're doing concerts with them.
Moving from the sublime to the ridiculous, we come to a gentleman with the unlikely name of A. Purvis Pullen. Is there anyone here who knows the stage name of A. Purvis Pullen? Okay. Nobody. All right. That's good. He is a whistler. But more than that, he can imitate all sorts of animals and birds. His sounds have been heard in Walt Disney's Sleeping Beauty and the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. His birds are to be heard by visitors to the tiki rooms at Disneyland and Disney World. You've probably heard him. His greatest renown came during his 20 years with Spike Jonze and the City Slickers. He's listed on many of Spike's records, but under a nom de plume, or nom de disque. May I present Dr. Horatio Q. Birdbath?
Bob on grave was dealing blue. The mortgage was long overdue, and he knew that the dear old farm would soon be sold. He saw the sheriff at the gate, and he knew that sheriff never waits. He looked out through the door, then lo and behold, the old cow said,
"Ah, ah,
we'll have lots of dough in a week or so, and we won't have to sell the farm." Then the old pig said, that they liked so well in the big hotel, and we won't have to sell the farm. Well, get out the fiddle, hi diddle diddle, the old mule said so gay. I've thought it over, I'll eat the clover, and you can get some money for the hay, 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 then the rooster said. We'll see you through, cock-a-doodle-doo, and we won't have to sell the farm. Well, the old tomcat, I can live, said he, just on toast and tea, so we won't have to sell the farm. Then the little dog said, and we'll search the pans and tomato cans, so we won't have to sell the farm. Well, up jumped the rabbit.
I don't know that one.
Ah, got you that time, eh? I'm not objecting if you're suspecting that I'm worth my money in the frying pan. Then the sheriff said, as he shook his head, if things keep growing in the way that they're going in a week or so, the gum will have so much dough that you won't have to sell the farm. Then the parrot said, that we won't have to sell the farm.
That's something. What happened after Bernie then?
Well, then I've been with Bernie for 10 years.
Well, now, after Bernie, did you start working with some other band, or did you go into Hollywood work?
Well, after Ben Bernie, and he passed away in 41, then I did war work, you know.
Yes.
And when I was released, I went to Hollywood, and I worked with Amos and Andy. And I was a Rinso Whitebird. That Rinso White. That happened in a little Wash Day song.
That was you?
That's right.
The makers of the new Rinso bring you the Amos and Andy Show with their guest tonight, Mr. Charles Coburn.
Oh, heaven's sakes. I remember that when I was a kid.
Yeah, so Amos and Andy said, well, we've got enough of that there, Rinso White Bird. We'd like you to call a friend of ours on the phone. We think he can use your unusual thousand bird and animal effects. Who's that? He said his name is Lindley Armstrong Jones. Well, I didn't know who that was, so I says okay. So I got on the phone, called his home, and Spike talked to me. He said, "Who is this?" I said, "This is A. Purvis Pullen." Oh my Lord, what a name! To get up in the morning, it was at 12 o'clock noon. He says, "To hear a name like that," he He said, what do you do? I said, well, I've been doing the Risa Whiteberg. My name is Hernandez, and they gave me your name, and they told me to call you. And he said, well, what do you do? I said, well, I do 1,000 birds and animals. Oh, he says, okay, hey, how about an ass? I went, he said, how about a bee for a bear? And he said, how about a C for a cat? How about a D for a dog? Well, I got going up in the alphabet. He said, that's enough. He said, come on out from the house. So I went, that was in 1945,
uh-huh.
And I joined him. And stayed with him until he died in 1965.
Oh, isn't that something?
I made 65 records with Spike.
Uh-huh.
And I was featured on 18. My name's on it as Dr. Birdman. Oh, he named me Dr. Birdman.
How'd that come about?
Well, we were in this room, and he has a little daughter, Linda, there, and he said, I hate that name of A. Purposeful. It's the worst thing I ever heard. He said, we got to give you a moniker or something of your birds. So he said, I'm going to give you the title of a doctor of ornithology, which is bird study.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, how about making me a success and using Horatio in there? He said, that's good. Horatio Alger Jr. series will use Horatio. I said, right. So he said, all right, now, because of your bird, I'm calling you Horatio, Dr. Horatio Bird. Because you do that bird noise, right. And then he gave me the name of Bath because I poured water out of a tuba onto the city slickers on every show. And that was the Bath part, all right? I said, well, that's fine, Dr. Horatio Birdman. No, no. He said, we got to get a wonderful initial in there. That means something. So he said, I got it. It's going to be Dr. Horatio Chew Birdman. I said, Chew? What's the Chew stand for? He says, that's going to stand for quinine because you're hard to take.
My program, The Spirit of 78, is heard in about 25 stations coast to coast. Its listeners are mostly of an older generation, but other young people and baby boomers who never heard this kind of music have been listening and cherish now the music that I've whetted their appetites for with these cherished old records. Regrettably, it's difficult to overcome the resistance of public radio program managers who themselves are unfamiliar with the music that we love and collect. As a result, I'm not presently heard in such retirement areas as Florida, Sun City, Palm Springs, or Southern California. They love me in Fargo, North Dakota, however. Perhaps as a result of hearing this presentation, you might be able to promote my program on your local national public radio station. I'd appreciate it. And thank you for letting me share the Spirit of 78.